wind blew against them from the west. "It is a good way to be warmed," Yuan said, smiling at them. "Better than any other fire." The young men laughed to please Yuan, for they liked him. But the village lads stayed sullen in spite of their reddened cheeks. That night in his room, alone, Yuan wrote it all down to Mei Ling, for it had come to be a thing as necessary as food and drink to him, to end his day by telling her what it held. When he was finished, he rose and went to the window and looked out over the city. The dark, tiled roofs of the old houses huddled here and there, black in the moonlight. But thrusting up everywhere among them sharply were the tall, new houses, red-roofed, angular and foreign, their many windows shining with inner light. Across the city, the few great new streets flung out wide pathways of light and glitter and dimmed the moon. Looking at this changing city, seeing it and yet not seeing it much either, because she saw most clearly Mei Ling's face, very clear and young before his mind, the city only a background for her face. Suddenly the fourth line of his verse came to his mind, as finished as though he saw it printed down. He ran to the table and seized the letter he had just sealed, and tearing it open he added to it these words. "These four lines came to me today, the first three on the land, but I could not find the last perfecting line until I came back to the city and I thought of you. Then it came as simply as though you had spoken it to me." So Yuan lived in the city, his days full of his work, and his nights full of his letters to Mei Ling. She did not write so often to him. Her letters were sedately put, the words few and exact. But they were not dull, because her words, since they were so few, were full of her meaning. She told him Ailan had come back after her months away, for those two had stayed their month of play over several times, and were only now come home. And Mei Ling said, "Ailan is more beautiful than ever, but some warmth has gone out of her. Perhaps her child will bring this back. It will be born in less than a month. She comes home often because she says she sleeps better in her old bed." And she told him, "Today I did my first real operation. It was to cut off the foot of a woman which had been bound in childhood until it was gangrened. I was not frightened." And she said, "I ever love to go and play with the foundling babes, of whom I am one. They are my sisters." And she told often of some merry, childish thing they said. Once she wrote, "Your uncle and his eldest son have sent a command for Sheng to come home. He spends too much silver, they say, since they can collect no rents these days from the old lands, and the eldest son's wife is not willing for her husband's wage to be sent abroad, and there is no great sum to be found otherwise. Therefore Sheng must come, because he is to have no more money." This Yuan read thoughtfully, remembering Sheng as he had last seen him, excellently clothed in new garments, swinging a small shining cane as he walked along a sunny street in that great foreign city. It was true he spent much money, since he was careful of his beauty. Doubtless he must come home. Doubtless it was the only way to make him come home. Then Yuan thought, remembering the fawning woman, "It is better for him to come home. I am glad he must leave her at last." Always, Mei Ling answered very carefully every question Yuan wrote to her. As the winter deepened, she cautioned him to wear a thicker coat and to eat well, and he must sleep long and not work too hard. Many times she bade him take care against the winds in the old schoolroom. But there was one thing she never answered in his letters. He said in every letter, "I am not changed. I love you, and I wait." This she did not answer. Nevertheless, Yuan thought her letters very perfect ones. 4 times a month, as certain as the day came, he knew he could expect to find upon his table when he went to his room at night the long shape of her letter, and her writing on it, clear and somewhat small in shape. These 4 days in each month came to be his feast days, and for sheer pleasure in his certainty, he bought a little calendar and marked ahead the days he would have her letters. He marked them in red, and there were 12 in all until the new year, when there was holiday, and then he might go home to her and see her face. Beyond that, he would not mark, because he had his secret hope. Thus Yuan lived from seventh day to seventh day, scarcely caring to go elsewhere than to his work, and needing no friends, because his heart was fed. Yet Meng would come sometimes and force him forth, and then Yuan sat in a tea-house somewhere for an evening, and listened to Meng and his friends cry out their impatience. For Meng was not so triumphant as he seemed at first. Yuan listened, and he heard Meng angry still, and still he cried out against the times, even against these new times. On one such night in a tea-house newly opened in the new street, Yuan sat at dinner with him and four young fellow captains, and these were all dissatisfied with everything. The lights above the table were first too bright and then not bright enough, and the food was not brought fast enough to please them, and they wanted a certain white foreign wine that was not to be had. Between Meng and the other four, the serving man was in a sweat, and he mopped his shaven head and panted and ran to and fro, afraid not to please these young captains who carried shining weapons at their belts. Even when the singing girls came in, and after the new foreign fashion danced and threw their limbs about, the young man would not be satisfied, but spoke loudly of how this one's eyes were small as any pig's eyes, and that one had a nose like a leek, and one was too fat and one too old, until the girl's eyes were full of tears and anger. And Yuan, though he did not think them beautiful, could not but pity them, and so he said at last, "Let be. They have their rice to earn somehow." At this, one young captain said loudly, "Better they starve, I say." And laughing their loud, bitter young laughter, they rose at last with a great clatter of their swords and parted. But that night, Meng went on foot with Yuan to his room, and as they walked along the streets together, he spoke his discontent, and he said, "The truth is we are all angry, because our leaders are not just to us. And the revolution, it is a principle that we shall all be equal, and all have equal opportunity. Yet even now our leaders are oppressing us. That general of mine, you know him, Yuan, you saw him. Well, and there he sits like any old warlord, drawing a great pay each month as head of the armies of this region, and we younger ones are kept always in one place. I rose quickly to be a captain, and so quickly I was full of hope and ready to do anything in our good cause, expecting to rise yet higher. Yet though I work and spend myself, I stick here, a captain. We all can rise no higher than being captains. Do you know why? It is because that general fears us. He is afraid we will be greater than he is some day. We are younger and more able, and so he keeps us down. Is this the spirit of the revolution?" And Meng stopped beneath a light and poured out his hot questions at Yuan, and Yuan saw Meng's face as angry as it used to be in his sullen boyhood. By now the few passers-by were staring sidewise curiously, and Meng saw them and he dropped his voice, and went on again, and at last he said very sullenly, "Yuan, this is not the true revolution. There must be another. These are not our true leaders. They are as selfish as the old lords of war. Yuan, we young ones, we must start again. The common people are as oppressed as they ever were. We must strike again for their sakes. These leaders we have now have forgotten wholly that the common people..." Now, even as Meng said this, he paused and stared. For just ahead at a certain gateway to a very famous pleasure house, there was a brawl arising. The lights from that pleasure house shone down as red and bright as blood, and in the light they saw a very hateful sight. A foreign sailor from some foreign ship, such as Yuan had seen upon the great river which flowed past the city, in half-drunkenness was beating with his coarse, clenched fists the man who had pulled him to that pleasure house in his vehicle. He was shouting in his drunkenness and anger, and staggering stupidly upon his clumsy feet. Now Mung, when he saw how the white man struck the other, started forward, and he began to run swiftly, and Yuan ran after him. As they came near, they heard the white man cursing foully the rickshaw puller, because he dared to ask for more coin than the white man wished to give. And under his blows the man cowered, shielding himself with his upraised arms. For the white man was large and rude in body, and his drunken blows were cruel when they fell. Now Mung had reached them, and he shouted at the foreigner, "You dare! You dare!" And he leaped at the man and caught his arms and pinioned them behind his back. But the sailor would not submit so easily, and he did not care that Mung was a captain or what he was. To him all men not of his kind were the same, and all to be despised, and he turned his curses onto Mung. And the two would have jumped upon each other then and there in mutual hatred, except that Yuan and the rickshaw puller sprang between them and fended off the blows. And Yuan besought Mung, saying in an agony, "He is drunk. This fellow, a common fellow, you forget yourself." And while he cried, he made haste to push the drunken sailor through the gate to the pleasure house, where he forgot the quarrel and went on his way. Then Yuan put his hand to his pocket and brought forth some scattered copper coin and gave them to the rickshaw man, and so settled the quarrel. And the man, who was a small, old, weazened fellow, never fed well enough in a day, was pleased to have the thing end thus. And in his gratitude he cackled out a little laughter, and he said, "You understand the doctrine, sir. It is true enough one ought not to blame a child, nor a woman, nor a man drunk." Now Mung had stood there panting, and very hot with anger all this time. And since he had not freed his anger fully on the sailor, it was more than half in him still, and he was beside himself. When he saw how easily the beaten man was assuaged with a few copper coins, and when he heard the poor laughter and the old adage he put into words again, Mung could not bear it. No, in some strange way his clean, right anger against the foreigner's insult to his own kind soured, and without a word his eyes blazed out anew now upon the rickshaw puller, and he leaned and gave the man's face a blow across the mouth. Yuan saw Mung do this thing, and he cried out, "Mung, what is it you do?" And he made haste to find a coin again to give the man for such a cruel blow. But the man did not take the money. He stood in a daze. The blow came so swiftly and without any expectation that he stood with his jaw hanging, and a little blood began to stream from the corner of his mouth. Suddenly he bent and picked up the shafts of the rickshaw, and he said to Yuan simply, "It was a harder blow than any the foreigner gave me." And so he went away. But Mung had not stayed a moment after he gave the blow. He strode off, and Yuan ran after him. When he came up to Mung, he was about to ask him why he gave the blow. But first he looked at Mung's face, and then he kept silent. For to his astonishment, he saw in the bright light of the streets that tears were running down Mung's cheeks. Through these tears Mung stared ahead, until at last he muttered furiously, "What is the use of fighting in any cause for people like these, who will not even hate the ones who oppress them? A little money sets everything right for such as these." And he left Yuan at that instant, and turned without another word into a dark side street. Then Yuan stood irresolute a moment, questioning if perhaps he should not follow Mung to see he did not do some further angry deed. But he was eager to reach his room, for it was the night of a seventh day, and he could see before him the shape of the letter waiting for him. And so once more he let Mung go his angry way, alone. At last the days drew near to the end of the year, and it came within a handful of days to the holidays when Yuan could see Mei Ling again. In those days whatever he did seemed only a means of waiting, until the one day when he would be freed. His work he did as well as he was able, but even his pupils ceased for him to have any life or meaning, and he could not greatly care if they did well or ill, or what they did. He went to bed early to hasten the night, and he rose early to begin the day and pass it over. And yet, in spite of all he did, the time went as slowly as though a clock were stopped. Once he went to see Meng and made a plan to take the same train homewards, for this time Meng was free for holiday too. And though he always said he was a revolutionist and he cared nothing if he never saw his home again, yet he was very restless in these days, and eager for some change or other he could not make, and he was willing to go home, having nothing better than to do. He never spoke to Yuan again of that night he had struck the common fellow. It seemed he had forgotten the thing, for now he was full of a new anger, and here it was that the common people were so willful they would not make the great feast day for the new year on the day the new government had said it must be. The truth was the people were used to a year timed by the moon, and now these new young men would have it timed by the sun, as it was in foreign countries, and the people were doubtful. And on the streets where there were placards put commanding all to make merry at the foreign New Year, the people gathered to look or to listen, if they could not read, to some scholar in their midst who read out the commands. Thus the people muttered everywhere, "How can the year be put anyhow like this? If we send up the kitchen god a month too soon, what will heaven think? Heaven does not count by any foreign sun, we swear." And so they stayed willful, and women would not make their cakes and meats, and men would not buy the mottoes of red paper to paste upon their doors for good fortune. Then the new young rulers grew very angry at such willfulness, and they made mottoes of their own, not of old foolish sayings of the gods, but of the sayings of the revolution, and they sent their own hirelings and pasted these mottoes on the doors by force. Of this Meng was full on the day when Yuan went to see him, and he ended all the story triumphantly. "So, whether they will or not, the people must be taught and forced out of old superstitious ways." But Yuan answered nothing, not knowing indeed what to say, since he could see the two sides of the thing. In those next 2 days left, Yuan looked, and it was true he saw everywhere the new mottoes being pasted upon doors. There was no word said against it. Everywhere men and women watched the new red papers put upon their doors, and they stayed silent. A man here and there might laugh a little, or he spat into the dust, and went his way as though he were full of something he would not tell. But men and women worked as usual everywhere, and as though there was no feast day for them in that whole year anywhere. Though all the doors were gay and newly red, the common people seemed not to see anything at all, but went with ostentatious usualness to their usual work. And Yuan could not but smile a little secretly, although he knew Meng's anger had a cause, and although, if he had been asked, he would have acknowledged the people ought to obey. But then Yuan smiled more easily these days about any small thing, because somehow he felt Mei Ling must be changed and warmer. Though she had not answered any word of love he wrote, at least she read the words, and he could not believe she forgot them all. For him, at least, it was the happiest, gayest year he ever had begun in his life, because he hoped much from it. Chapter 29. In such expectation Yuan began his holidays that Meng's angers even could not throw a cloud upon him, although Meng came as near to a quarrel with Yuan upon that day's journey as Yuan would let him. The truth was that Meng was in some such fierce, secret inner discontent that nothing pleased him, and in the train he was inflamed immediately against a rich man who spread his fur robes to take twice the space he should upon a seat, so that a lesser-seeming man must stand. And then he was inflamed as much against the lesser man because he bore it. At last Yuan could not forbear smiling, and he made a little thrust at Meng half-merrily, and said, "Nothing will please you, Meng, not rich because they are rich, nor poor because they are poor." but Meng was too sore secretly to hear any merriment at all about himself. He turned furiously on Yuan then, and said in a fierce, low tone, "Yes, and you are the same. You bear anything. You are the lukewarmest soul I ever knew. Never fit to be a true revolutionist." At Meng's fierceness, Yuan could not but grow grave. He answered nothing, for all the people stared at Meng, and though he made his voice too low to let them hear what he said, still his face was so angry and his eyes so blazing under his black brows drawn down that they were afraid of such a one, who had a pistol thrust into his belt besides. Therefore Yuan sat silent. But in his silence he could not but acknowledge Meng spoke the truth, and he was wounded a little, although he knew Meng was angry at some hidden thing and not at him. So Yuan sat in soberness for a while as the train wound its way through the valleys, hills, and fields, and he fell to thinking and to asking himself what he was and what he wanted most. It was true he was no great revolutionist, and never would be, because he could not hold his hates long, as Meng could. No, he could be angry for a while and hate for a moment, but not for long. The thing he truly wanted was a peace in which to do his work, and the work he loved best was what he did now. The best hours he had spent were those he used to teach his pupils, except his hours of writing to his love. Across his dreaming, Meng's voice broke scornfully, saying, "What are you thinking of, Yuan? You sit there smiling as silly as a boy who has had barley sugar thrust unawares into his mouth." Then Yuan could not but laugh shamefacedly and curse the heat he felt rush into his face. For Meng was not one to whom he could tell such thoughts as now were his. Yet what meeting can ever be so sweet as it is dreamed? When Yuan reached his home on the evening of that day, he leaped up the steps and into the house. But again, there was only silence. And after a moment a serving woman came and gave him greeting and said, "My mistress says you are to go at once to your eldest cousin's house, where there is a family feast made for the homecoming of the young lord who has been in foreign countries. She awaits you there." Now, above his interest in this news of Sheng's coming home, was Yuan's eagerness to know if Mei Ling was gone with the lady or not. Yet, however he longed to know, he would not ask a servant of her, for there is no mind so quick as a servant's mind to put a man and a maid together. Therefore he must make his heart wait until he could get to his uncle's house and see for himself if Mei Ling were there. All during these many days, Yuan had dreamed of how he would first see Mei Ling, and always he dreamed it that he saw her alone. They met, magically, alone, inside the door as he stepped into the house. Somehow she would be there. But she was not there, and even if she were at his cousin's house, he could not hope to see her alone, and he dare not seem other to her than cool and courteous before the eyes of his family. And so it was. He went to his cousin's house and into the large room, which was full of rich foreign ornaments and chairs, and there were all they gathered. Meng was before Yuan, and they had only finished making welcome for him when Yuan came in, and fresh welcome must begin for him. He must go and bow before his old uncle, now wakeful and very merry with all his sons about him, except the one he gave the tiger, and the one who was hunchback and a priest. But these neither he nor his lady counted any more as sons. There the old pair sat in their best holiday robes, and the lady was full of her place and dignity, and she smoked very gravely a water pipe a maid stood and filled for her every puff or two, and in her hand she held a rosary, whose brown beads she passed constantly between her fingers, and still she took it on herself to say a balancing moral word to every jest the old man made. When he had given reply to Yuan, he shouted, his old loose face in a thousand wrinkles, "Well, Yuan, here is this son of mine home again as pretty as a girl, and all our fears of a foreign wife were needless. He is still unwed." At this, the aged lady said very sedately, "My lord, Sheng was ever much too wise to think of such wickedness. I pray you do not speak foolishly in your age." But for once the old man would not be afraid of the lady's tongue. He felt himself the head of this house, and head of all these goodly young men and women in this rich house, and he grew waggish, and he was made bold by the presence of others, and he cried, "It is nothing untoward to speak of marriage for a son, I suppose? I suppose Sheng will be wed?" To which the lady answered with majesty, "I know it is the proper way in these new days, and my son need not complain that his mother forced him against his will." Then Yuan, who had listened half-smiling to this bickering between the old pair, saw a strange thing. He saw Sheng smile a little cold, sad smile, and he said, "No, mother, I am not so new after all. Wed me as you like, I do not care. Women are the same to me anywhere, I think." At this, Ailan laughed and said, "It is only because you are too young, Sheng." And in her laughter the others joined, and the moment passed. Except Yuan did not forget Sheng's look, the look in his eyes, while he steadily smiled and while the others laughed. It was the look of one who greatly cares for nothing, not even for what woman he is to wed. Yet how could Yuan think deeply on this night of Sheng? Before even he had bowed to the old pair, his eyes sought and found Mei Ling. He saw her first of all, standing very still and quiet beside the lady, her foster mother. And for one flying second, their eyes met, although they did not smile. But there she was, and Yuan could not be wholly disappointed, even though it was not as he dreamed. It was now enough that she was here in this room, even though he did not say a word to her. Then he thought he would not say a word to her, not now, not in this crowded room. Let their true meeting be afterwards, and in some other place. Yet though Yuan looked at her very often, he never caught her eyes after that one first time. But the lady his mother gave him very warm greeting, and when he went to her she caught his hand and patted it a little before she dropped it, and Yuan stayed by her a moment. Although when he did, Mei Ling made excuse to slip away to fetch some small thing she wanted. Nevertheless, although he gave himself to all these others, there was the warmth of knowing her presence, and when he could do it, he let his eyes find her again and again as she moved to pour tea into some bowl or to give a sweetmeat to a child. All the talk and greetings were mostly for Sheng this night, and Meng and Yuan were soon only part of the others. Sheng was more beautiful than ever, and so beautiful and seeming so to know everything and be at ease in all he said and did, that Yuan was shy before him, as he always used to be, and he felt himself a youth again before this finished man. But Sheng would not have it so. He took Yuan's hand in his old friendly way and held it, and Yuan felt the touch of Sheng's smooth, graceful fingers, shaped so like a woman's hands, and the touch was pleasant and yet somehow distasteful, and so was the look Sheng had now in his eyes. For all its sweet, seeming frankness, there was in these days something near to evil in Sheng's face and way, as there is in a flower too fully blown, and whose scent is heavy with something more than fragrance. But why this was, Yuan did not know. Sometimes he felt he imagined it, and yet again he knew he did not. For Sheng, although he laughed and talked, and his laughter was always nicely rightly made, and his voice even as a bell, not high nor low, but very softly toned, and although he seemed to enter into all the family gossip with readiness and pleasure, yet Yuan felt Sheng himself was not there at all, but somewhere very far away. He could not but wonder if Sheng were sorry to be home again. And once he seized a chance when he was near to ask him quietly, "Sheng, were you sorry to leave that foreign city?" He watched Sheng's face for answer, but the face was smooth and golden and untroubled, and his eyes as smooth as dark jade. And telling nothing more, And Sheng smiled his lovely, ready smile and answered, "Oh, no, I was ready to come home. It makes no difference to me where I am." Again Yuan asked, "Have you written more verse?" And Sheng answered carelessly, "Yes, I have a little book printed now of my verses, a few of them you saw, but nearly all new since you left. If you like, I will give you a copy before you go tonight." And he only smiled when Yuan said simply he would like to have them. Once more, Yuan asked a question, and he asked, "Shall you stay here to live or come to the new capital?" Then only did Sheng answer quickly, and as though here were one thing which mattered to him, and he said, "Oh, I stay here, of course. I have been so long away I am used to modern life. I could not, of course, live in so raw a city as that is. Meng has told me something, and though he is so proud of the new streets and houses, still he had to tell me when I asked him that there is no modern way to bathe oneself, no amusement houses worth the name, no good theaters, nothing, in fact, for a cultivated man to enjoy." I said, "My dear Meng, what is there, pray, in this city of which you are so proud?" And then he went into one of his glowering silences. "How little Meng has changed!" And all this Sheng said in the foreign tongue he now spoke so easily and well that it came more quickly to his tongue than his own native one. But his elder brother's wife found Sheng very perfect, and so did Ailan and her husband. These three could not look at him enough, and Ailan, though she was then big with child, laughed more in her old merry way than she did usually nowadays, and made free with Sheng and took great delight in him. And Sheng answered all her wit and paid her praise, and Ailan took it willingly. And it was true she was still as pretty as she ever was in spite of her burden. Yes, when other women grew thick and dark in the face and sluggish in their blood, Ailan was only like a lovely flower at its height, a rose wide in the sun. To Yuan she cried a lively greeting as her brother, but to Sheng she gave her smiles and wit. And her handsome husband watched her carelessly and lazily and without jealousy. For however beautiful Sheng might be, he still thought himself more beautiful and more to be preferred by any woman, and most of all by the one whom he had chosen. He loved himself too well for jealousy. So in the talk and laughter the feast began, and they all sat together, not as in ancient times divided into old and young. No, in these days there was not such division. It is true the old lord and his lady sat in the highest seats, but their voices were not heard in the laughing back and forth of Ailan and Sheng and of the others who took part sometimes. It was a very merry hour, and Yuan could not but be proud of all these his blood kin, these rich, well-clad folk, every woman in the finest, gayest hue of satin robe cut to the hour's fashion, and the men except the old uncle in their foreign garb, and Meng haughty in his captain's uniform, and even the children gay in silks and foreign ribbons, and the table covered with dishes of every foreign sort, and foreign sweets and foreign wines. Then Yuan thought of something, and here it was. These were not all his family. No, many miles in from the sea the tiger, his own father, lived as he ever did, and so did Wang the merchant and all his sons and daughters. They spoke no foreign tongue, they ate no foreign thing, and they lived as their own forefathers did. If they were brought into this room, Yuan thought, half troubled, they would be very ill at ease. The old tiger would soon be pettish, because he could not spit as freely as he was used, for on this floor was spread a flowered silken carpet, and though he was not a poor man, he was used at best to brick or tile. And the merchant would be in a misery at all this money spent on pictures and on satin-covered seats and little foreign toys, and all those foreign rings and trinkets which the women wore. Nor could this half of Wang Lung's house have borne the life the tiger lived, nor even the life in the home where Wang the merchant lived, which Wang Lung had left for his sons in that old town. these grandchildren and great-grandchildren would hold it too mean to live in, cold in winter except where the southern sun struck it, and unceiled, and not modern anywhere, and not a fit house for them. As for the earthen house, it was no more than a hovel, and they had forgotten it was, even. But Yuen did not forget. In the strangest flash of memory, sitting at this feast and looking all about the table, white-clothed in the new foreign fashion, he suddenly remembered that earthen house, and when he remembered it, he liked it, somehow, still. He was not wholly one of them, he thought slowly, not with Ailan, not with Sheng. Their foreign looks and ways made him wish to be less foreign even than he was. Yet he could not live in that earthen house either. No, though he liked something about it very deeply. He knew now he could not live there as his grandfather once had lived in content and feel at home. He was between, somehow, and it was a lonely place. Between, as he was, this foreign house and house of earth. He had no real home, and his was a very lonely heart which could not be wholly here nor there. His eyes rested on Sheng a moment. Except for his gold skin and for his dark, pointed eyes, Sheng might be completely foreign. The very movements of his body now were foreign, and he spoke as a man from the West does. Yes, and Ailan liked it, and so did the cousin's wife, and even the eldest cousin felt Sheng very new and full of something modish, and he was silent and abashed, and somewhat envious, and for solace he ate heavily in silence. Then quickly and secretly Yuen looked at Mei Ling, jealous because he had thought of a thing when he saw the praise of Sheng and Ailan's eyes. Did Mei Ling also watch Sheng as the other younger women did, and laugh at all he said to make them laugh, and admire him with her eyes too? He saw her look at Sheng calmly, and turn her gaze away again tranquilly. His heart eased itself. Why, she was like himself. She was between, too, not wholly new, and yet different from the old. He looked at her once more, hot and longing, and he felt the waves of talk and laughter break over him, and for a moment took his fill of her through his eyes. There she sat beside the lady, and now she leaned and with her chopsticks picked a bit of white meat daintily from a central dish and put it on the lady's dish and smiled at her. She was, Yuen said most passionately within himself, as far from Ailan and her kind as a lily growing wild beneath bamboos is different from a forced camellia. Yes, she was between, too. Well, then he was not lonely. Suddenly, Yuen's heart was so warm and ready that he could not believe Mei Ling would not be ready too. In this one love of his heart flowed out, and all his many feelings fused most ardently into this one swift course. That night he went to bed and lay sleepless, planning how he would talk with Mei Ling alone the next day, and feel how her heart was to him now. For surely, or so he thought, the many letters he had written must mean some change in her to warmth. He planned how they would sit and talk, or perhaps he might persuade her to walk with him even, since many maids walked alone these days with young men whom they knew and trusted. And he bethought himself how he might say he was a sort of brother to her, if she hesitated. And then quickly he rejected this excuse, and he said stoutly in himself, "No, I am not her brother, whatever else I may not be." Only at last could he fall asleep, and then to dream awry, and without completion of any dream. Chapter 30. But who could foretell that this was the night when Ailan would give birth to her child? Yet so it was. When Yuan woke in the morning, it was to hear confusion through all the house, and the noise of servants running here and there. And when he rose and washed and clothed himself and went to the dining room, there was the table only half set for the meal, and a sleepy maidservant moved to and fro languidly, and the only other in the room was Ailan's husband, who sat there dressed as he had been the night before. When Yuan came in, he said gaily, "Never be a father, Yuan, if one's wife is the new sort of woman. I have had as hard a time as though I bore the child, sleepless, and Ailan crying out and making such a wailing I thought her near her end. Except the doctor and Mei Ling promised me she did very well. These women nowadays bear their children very hardly. Lucky it is a boy, I say, because Ailan has already called me to her bed this morning to swear me there will never be another child from her." He laughed again, and passed his beautiful smooth hand across his laughing, half-rueful face. And then he sat down to eat with great appetite the food the serving maid set there, for he had been father several times before this, and so it was no great thing to him now. Thus was Ailan's child born in this house, and all the household was absorbed and busied in it. And Yuan caught no glance at Mei Ling scarcely beyond a passing moment here and there. 3 times a day the physician came, and nothing would please Ailan except a foreign one, and so he came, a tall, red-haired Englishman, and he saw her and talked with Mei Ling and the lady, and told them what Ailan must eat and how many days she must rest. There was the child, too, to be cared for, and Ailan would have it that Mei Ling must do this herself. And so Mei Ling did, and the child wept much, because the milk of the nurse they hired at first was not suited to its needs, and so this one and that must be found and tried. For Ailan, like many of her kind these days, would not feed her son from her own breasts, lest they grow too large and full and spoil her slender looks. This was the only great quarrel Mei Ling ever made with her. She cried accusingly to Ailan, "You are not fit to have this good, sweet son. Here he is born strong and lusty and starving, and your 2 breasts running full, and you will not feed him. Shame, shame, Ailan!" Then Ailan wept with anger, and she pitied herself too, and she cried back at Mei Ling, "You know nothing of it. How can you know who are a virgin? You don't know how hard it has been to have a child in me for months and months, and my clothes hideous on me. And now, after all my pain, am I to go hideous another year or two? No, let such coarse work be done by serving women. I will not, I will not." Yet, though Ailan wept, her pretty face all flushed and distraught, Mei Ling would not give in so lightly, and this was how Yuan heard of the quarrel. For Mei Ling carried it to Ailan's husband, and Yuan was in the room. While she besought the father, Yuan listened in enchantment, for it seemed to him he never had seen how true and lovely Mei Ling was. She came in swiftly, full of her anger, and without seeing Yuan, she began to speak earnestly to the father. "Will you let this be? Will you let Ailan hold back her own milk from the child? The child is hungry, and she will not feed it." But the man only laughed and shrugged himself and said, "Has anyone ever made Ailan do what she would not? At least I have never tried, and could not dare it, now most certainly. Ailan is a modern woman, you know." He laughed and glanced at Yuan, but Yuan was watching Mei Ling. Her grave eyes grew large as she held them to the man's smiling face, and her clear, pale face went paler, and she said quickly beneath her breath, "Oh, wicked, wicked, wicked!" and turned and went away again. When she was gone, the husband said affably to Yuan, as men may speak when no women are by, "After all, I cannot blame Ailan. It is a very binding thing to nurse a brat, and force oneself to be home every hour or two, and I could not ask her to give up her pleasure. And the truth is, I like to have her keep her beauty, too. Besides, the child will do as well on some servant's milk as hers." But when he heard this, Yuan felt a passionate defense of Mei Ling, She was right in all she said and did. He rose abruptly to leave this man whom somehow now he did not like.
As for me, he said coldly, I think a woman may be too modern sometimes. I think Eilon is wrong here.
And he went slowly to his room, hoping on the way to meet Mei Ling, but he did not. Thus, one by one, the few days of his holidays crept past, and not on any one day did he see Mei Ling above 10 minutes or so, and never then alone, for she and the lady were always bent together over the newborn babe, the lady in a sort of ecstasy, because here was the son at last she had so longed for once. Though she was so used to new ways, yet now she took a sweet half-shamed pleasure in a few old ways, too, and she dyed some eggs red, and bought some silver trinkets and made ready for his month-old birthday feast, although the time was still far off. And in every plan she made she must talk with Mei Ling, and almost she seemed to forget Eilon was the child's mother. She depended so on the foster daughter. But long before this birthday was come, Yuan must go back to the new city to do his work. Now as the days passed, they passed very empty for him, and after a while he grew sullen, and then he told himself that Mei Ling need not be so busy, and that she could make time for him if she would. And when he had so thought for a day or two, while the last day drew very near, he felt sure he felt rightly, and that Mei Ling did what she did on purpose, not to see him any time alone. And in her new pleasure in the child, even the lady seemed to forget him, and that he loved Mei Ling. So it was, even until the day he must go back. On that day, Sheng came in very gaily, and he said to Yuan and to Eilon's husband, I am bid to a great merrymaking tonight at a certain house, and they lack a youth or two in number. And will you two forget your age for once, and pretend you are young again, and be partners to some pretty ladies? Eilon's husband answered with ready laughter that he would very willingly, and that he had been so tied to Eilon these 14 days, he had forgot what pleasure was. But Yuan drew back somewhat, for he had gone to no such merrymaking for years now, and not since he used to go with Eilon, and he felt the old shyness on him when he thought of strange women. But Sheng would have him, and the two pressed him, and though at first Yuan would not go, then he thought recklessly, Why should I not? It is a stupid thing to sit in this house and wait for the hour that never comes. What does Mei Ling care how I make merry? So, forced by this thought, he said aloud, Well, then I will go. Now all these days Mei Ling had not seemed to see Yuan, so busy had she been. But that one night, when he came out of his room dressed in his black foreign clothes, which he had been used to wear at evening, she happened to pass him, holding in her arms the little new boy who was asleep. She asked wonderingly, Where are you going, Yuan? He answered,
To an evening's merrymaking with Sheng and Eilon's husband.
He fancied at that moment he saw a look change in Mei Ling's face. But he was not sure, and then he thought he must be wrong, for she only held the sleeping child more closely to her, and said quietly, I hope you have a merry time, then. And so she went on. As for Yuan, he went his way hardened against her, and to himself he thought,
Well, then I will be merry. This is my last evening, and I will see how to make it very merry.
And so he did. That night Yuan did what he had never done before. He drank wine freely, and whenever anyone called out to him to drink, and he drank until he did not see clearly the face of any maid he danced with, but he only knew he had some maid or other in his arms. He drank so much of foreign wines to which he was not used, that all the great flower-decked pleasure hall grew before his eyes into a sort of swimming, glittering, moving maze of brightness. Yet for all this he held his drunkenness inside him very well, so that none knew except himself how drunken he truly was.
Even Sheng cried out in praise of him and said, "Yuan, you are a lucky fellow. You are one of those who grow paler as he drinks instead of red as we lesser fellows do. I swear it is only your eyes that betray you, but they burn as hot as coals." Now, in this night's drinking, he met one whom he had seen somewhere before. She was a woman whom Sheng brought to him, saying, "Here is a new friend of mine, Yuan. I'll lend her to you for a dance. And then you must tell me if you have found one who does so well." So Yuan found himself with her in his arms, a strange little slender creature in a long foreign dress of white, glittering stuff. And when he looked down at her face, he thought he knew it, for it was not a face easily forgotten. Very round and dark, and the lips thick and passionate, a face not beautiful but strange and to be looked at more than once. Then she said herself, half wondering, "Why, I know you. We were on the same boat. Do you remember?" Then Yuan forced his hot brain, and he did remember, and he said, smiling, "You are the girl who cried you would be free always." At this her great black eyes grew grave, and her full lips, which were painted thick and very red, pouted, and she answered, "It is not easy being free here. Oh, I suppose I am free enough, but horribly lonely." And suddenly she stopped dancing, and pulled Yuan's sleeve and cried, "Come and sit down somewhere and talk with me. Have you been as miserable as I? Look, I am the youngest child of my mother who is dead, and my father is next to the chief governor of the city. He has 4 concubines, all nothing but sing-song girls. You can imagine the life I lead. I know your sister. She is pretty, but she is like all the others. Do you know what their life is? It is gamble all day, gossip, dance all night. I can't live it. I want to do something. What are you doing?" These earnest words came so strangely from her painted lips that Yuan could not but heed them. She listened restlessly after a while when Yuan told her of the new city and his work there, and how he had found a little place of his own, and, he thought, a small work to do. When Sheng came and took her hand to bring her back into the dance, she thrust him pettishly away, and pouted her 2 full lips at him, and she cried earnestly, "Leave me alone. I want to talk seriously with him." At this, Sheng laughed and said teasingly, "Yuan, you would make me jealous if I thought she could be serious about anything." But the girl had turned already again to Yuan, and she began to pour out her passionate heart to him. And all her body spoke, too, the little round bare shoulders shrugging, and her pretty plump hands moving in her earnestness. "Oh, I hate it all so, don't you? I can't go abroad again. My father won't give me the money. He says he can't waste any more on me, and all those wives gambling from morning to night. I hate it here. The concubines all say nasty things about me because I go places with men." Now Yuan did not like this girl at all, for he was repelled by her naked bosom, and by her foreign garb, and by her 2 red lips. But still he could feel her earnestness, and be sorry for her plight. And so he said, "Why do you not find something to do?" "What can I do?" she asked. "Do you know what I specialized in college? Interior decoration for Western homes. I've done my own room over. I've done a little in a friend's house, but not for pay. Who here wants what I have? I want to belong here. It's my country. But I've been away too long. I have no place anywhere, no country." By now Yuan had forgotten this was an evening meant for pleasure. He was so moved by the poor creature's plight. There she sat before his pitying gaze, gay in her silly shining clothes, and her painted eyes full of tears. But before he could think of a thing to say for her comfort, Sheng was back again. And now he would not have refusal. He did not see her tears. He put his arm about her waist and laughing at her, he swept her off with him into the whirling music, and Yuan was left alone. Somehow he had no heart to dance more, and all the gaiety was gone from the noisy hall. Once the girl came by in Sheng's arms, and now her face was turned up to his, and it was bright and empty again, and as though she had never spoken the word she had to Yuan. He sat thoughtfully a while, and let a servant fill his glass again and again, while he sat on alone. At the end of that night of pleasure, when they went home again, Yuan was steady still, though it was true the wine burned inside him like a fever. Yet he could be strong enough to let Hailan's husband lean on him, for that one could not walk alone any more, he was so drunken, and his whole face was crimson and he babbled like a foolish child. Now when Yuan struck at the door to be let in that night, it opened suddenly, and there, by the manservant who had opened it, was Mei Ling herself. And when the drunken man saw her, he seemed to think of something he remembered between Yuan and Mei Ling, and he cried, "Why, you should have gone. There was a pretty rival. She wouldn't leave Yuan. Dangerous, huh?" And he fell to laughing foolishly. Mei Ling answered nothing. When she saw the two, she said to the servant, coldly, "Take my sister's lord to his bed, since he is so drunken." But when he was gone, she held Yuan there with a sudden blazing gaze. Thus were these two alone at last, and Yuan felt Mei Ling's great angry eyes on him, and it was like a sobering blast of cold north wind upon him. He felt the heat within him die down quickly, and for an instant he almost feared her. She was so tall and straight and angry, and he was speechless. But she was not. No, all these days she had scarcely spoken to him, but now she did. And her words leaped from her, and she said,